Happy Monday, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. I feel like today is Friday. I don't know. I feel like it's the day after Thanksgiving already, although my stomach doesn't feel full. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. It's Monday. I'm glad you're here. This is wonderful. Today is very special for me because my colleague, Alex Dolan, is with us. Alex hosts Thrill Seekers Radio. He's also a musician. He is a social justice advocate. But most of all, he is just a fabulous author. He writes literary suspense like nobody else. So stay tuned because we're going to talk to him in just a second. Ready or not, here we go. Back, everyone. Let me tell you a little bit about Alex Dolan. He is a member of the ITW and Sisters in Crime. He's the guy who goes to the meetings in the kilt, so you know. He's also an executive committee member for the San Francisco Bay Area's Lit Quake Festival, which is really important that you know about. We're going to talk about that too. He's recorded 4 music albums. He's got a master's from Columbia. He's real pro-social media communication. He's really good at using all that stuff, whereas, as you all know, I'm a tech twit. It is my pleasure to welcome my friend to the show, Alex Dolan. Alex, welcome to Authors on the Air. I can't believe this is the first time you've ever been here.
You know what? I'm not sure if it is. I think we actually did something last year. But
it
feels like it's been a while.
It has been.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know you were also on Jenny Melchman's show, Next Steps with Jenny and the ITW, because that's how I found you, listening to that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's wonderful to be back. Yeah. And it's wonderful to have you back in the studio, too.
Thank you. I've missed everybody. I'm going crazy. I'm like double booking shows. I've lost my mind, but it's so much fun. I don't know anyone who goes to play the way I do. I don't go to work. I go to play. It's tons of fun talking to writers because I'm such a huge reader. And I don't know, Alex, if people out there know that everyone in our network, all the hosts are writers except for me. I'm the only person who's never written a book. But by the same token, I also read probably more than everybody else does too. So that's okay, isn't it?
You are a gifted storyteller. So whether or not you actually put that down into printed word, that's, you are, I think, same as everybody else. You're in the art of storytelling.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, I'm definitely in the art of listening to the stories, that's for sure. So I want to first talk about your day job because you are kind of a social justice guy, but you have a very interesting day job. But then we're going to find out how that brought you around to writing. Could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So for the past 20 years, I am in marketing communications, but I'm in what they would call pro-social marketing communications or social marketing. And it's basically just kind of doing marketing communications, but for things that have a positive social impact. And what I started out working for public television in Boston, and I moved out to California, and I kind of realized that I'd been doing a lot of independent initiatives. I'd been doing festivals that combined the arts and social justice, and wanted to learn how to actually do that full time. And so I ended up working with a few firms that specialized in this, and this was everything from working on anti-smoking campaigns to immigration reform to healthcare issues and, even traffic safety issues. And so everything that I've done is really trying to take that toolbox and try to use it to move the needle for social issues. And so that's kind of my day job. And these days, I'm working for a company that works in global desalination. So it's taking seawater and turning it into potable water.
How interesting. That's fascinating. I know about desalinization because I love going to Aruba, and that's the only thing they do for themselves that's not exported from another country. They have a huge desalinization plant, although they turn off water for 2 hours a day. I don't know if you knew that. And this is just like a little tidbit of crap that I have stored in my brain. I don't know why.
No,
in
the Caribbean, it's a big thing. Like if you have an island community that has, it's really big in island communities, and chances are that plant probably has my company's technology in it, or the company I work for.
How about that?
Part of it is that if you don't have a sustainable ecosystem that produces the adequate amount of rainfall, and you're a small island that has a booming tourist population that's coming and draining your resources, it makes a lot of sense to need to create more fresh water. Yeah. So no, it's a pretty common thing.
I know these little small things, you know the big things. We're a good team, Alex. How did all of the things that you're doing in your day job drive you to writing this beautiful literary suspense that you write, first with The Euthanist and now with The Empress of Tempera? I love both the books, but I have to tell you that The Empress book is so fascinating that I literally stopped reading it and started from the beginning, because generally I blow through a book pretty fast, and I started reading it again, but much slower. How did you connect those dots, or were they always there?
First off, thank you for that. And I think just working with it, I think a lot of these issues had just kind of been on my radar, and so I think it's more likely to, when you're coming up with story ideas, of just gravitating towards stories about things that you're interested in, and so these are just things that I find interesting. And thank you for the correct pronunciation of both of my titles, by the way. I just came off the book launch for the second book, The Empress of Tempera, and you'd be surprised. I mean,
Tempera, right?
One bookstore.
Deep fried Empress, right? Tempera.
So a lot of people were saying Empress of Tempera, and so for those listening who are just kind of learning about me for the first time, so the second book that just came out is called The Empress of Tempera, and tempera is an egg-based paint. It's the kind of paint that Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo would have used. And you take a little pigment.
It's used in encaustic painting. I am familiar with that. One of my dearest friends is an artist, and hanging directly across from me is a tempera piece of work that she did. Fabulous.
Right, exactly, right. The Euthanist, my favorite pronunciation of that. So The Euthanist is a thriller about euthanasia and the death with dignity movement, but somebody had pronounced it The Enthusiast.
Enthusiast, so, yes, of course. I can see how that would happen.
Which is totally, yeah.
May I suggest you run your titles by somebody first and see that they don't get to
I know, I totally should, yeah. Well, book three has a lot easier title to pronounce. But to get back to your question, how did I, what made me want to write about this stuff? Part of it is the fact that I've been working it in these fields, and these issues are just kind of interesting to me. And part of it is like a deeper personal experience. I mean, the first book was about euthanasia and about the choices that we get to make when we reach the end of our lives and how much power we have over those choices. And that came on the heels of my dad passing away about 6 years ago now. And it was the original seed of that idea, started to kick around around that. And so it was very, you know, it made me start to think about how much control we have over our own death. And the second book is basically a thriller about the art world, which is a strange industry filled with really interesting people. And part of it was that I grew up as the son of two artists. And so I kind of grew up in that world. And I wanted to bring it to life and make it special. And you know, all my life I've been hearing about these stories about people fainting in front of Michelangelo's David, or, you know, the guy that shot the Pietà in the Sistine Chapel, not the Sistine Chapel, in the Vatican. And, you know, the fact that there are pieces of art out there that have this hold over people. And there's an excitement that I think that the average person who isn't in touch with that, I wanted to make them feel that. And there's a book that I really love by Ann Patchett, the book's called Bel Canto. And it's basically about an opera singer who is a hostage in a terrorist situation. And the way Ann Patchett writes about music in that book, she creates this magic about it that I wanted to create with the visual arts. And you know, me growing up with the visual arts, it felt very magical to me, and I wanted to try to convey how special that was and the excitement of it through a thriller.
It's
so
interesting that you
like very
speak about those
me.
Two pieces. Well, those two particular pieces really do evoke, and I have seen them, evoke different emotion, and just as any good book should. So I see the correlation right there. Also, I have to comment, I did not know that your folks were artists. So obviously creativity is something that you inherited from your parents and have nurtured along, because you're also a musician. You've got four albums to your name, correct?
I do, yeah. Growing up with my family, it was, you know, like I have a brother and a sister, and, you know, all three of us, they're like, you know, I feel like kids are kind of like little geishas. They're like, everyone's trained in every kind of form of the arts from a very young age. And that was very much the case in my family. Like, we were exposed to music, and we were exposed to the visual arts and writing and anything that could be a form of creative expression. And I gravitated towards music initially more than the visual arts. And my sister played cello for a long time, and she was a talented visual artist. And I think my brother gravitated more towards the visual arts. But it was, you know, it was basically exposing that, you know, the act of creating something, and then you figure out what resonates with you, like what's the platform that you're going to use. So for me,
wonderful.
It was music, and then it was writing.
You just said a great book title. I don't know if you even realized it when you were talking. You said Little Geishas, and I thought, you know, that's a really good name for a book, by the way.
It would also be a great band name.
It would be, and it'd also be a good title for your autobiography or your biography anyway, you know, about your family. How wonderful. Tell me, the music came first, and I know that you use your intro music on your radio show as part of something that is self-recorded, and it's really cute and it's really interesting, and I like it very much. Did you do a lot of looping for that particular song that you play as your intro for your radio show?
Yeah, there's a sampling. There's a period where for one album I recorded, I wanted a very big sound, and so there are about nine people on that album, and one is a turntablist, and so we used a lot of sampling on that album. So what you're listening to is, you know, you're listening to two different organs, guitar, bass, drums,
right.
And then you have like a few different tracks where we have samples layered over it, and then, you know, however many vocal tracks we layer down, yeah.
How fun!
But yeah, no, it's great to be able to have find a use for some of my recordings, and I like being able to sneak it into my own show. Yeah,
I love it. I think it's wonderful. I'm very blessed that very well-known author, Robert Gregory Brown, who is a fine thriller novelist and suspense novelist, very, very creative musician, composed the theme music for Authors on the Air. He also has written a musical for theater called Cradle Song. I can't wait to have him come on and we'll talk about it. So that'll be fun. But in the meantime, I want to go back to the writing because really that's what we're here to talk about. Have you dabbled in writing until you finally said, this is it, I'm going to go ahead and write a book? Or had you just been thinking about a storyline?
No, I started from a pretty early age. So in addition to my parents being artists, my dad was in publishing. And he worked for Houghton Mifflin for a long time. And I was brought up around books. And my dad basically typeset and bound a story that I wrote when I was 7 or 8 or something. And this was back in the days where you had to hand typeset things. So the labor involved was pretty intense. And it was only a few pages, but he bound it and he gave it to me. And it felt so good to have this thing that I did look professional that I just had the bug early on. And I think
how wonderful.
The trick
do you still
for
have
me,
the book?
Oh, yeah, I do, yeah.
Oh, good, okay, good.
It was an adventure
novel. So that was
novel.
It. I'm sorry, it was what?
It was, I was saying it was an adventure novel, but really it was about, you know, like 10 pages.
But that's okay
but yeah,
when
so
you're
he,
young
so I,
and you have that creative thing going on and someone sees it and nurtures it, that is a gift that stays with you your whole life. How wonderful.
Well, and not just my parents, but I think that along the way, you know, you're bringing up a really interesting point, which is I think what's kept me going is that I've had significant people along the way that have seen that kind of creativity and nurtured that. And that, you know, whether it's been teachers or professors or friends, people that just kind of have given me a nudge to keep going, that's really helped in terms of kind of trying to drive forward and getting that kind of encouragement. I think it's really important for somebody who's doing this.
Well, sure, because I would imagine that, you know, the typical parent who is not a creative themselves will say to a child, oh, okay, you want to be an author, that's fine. But will you, like, study medicine, too, just in case? So that's generally the typical reaction that you hear from parents. And teachers nowadays, I don't know if they still have the time and the ability to go ahead and especially nurture along one of their students. It just seems like it's, I mean, my daughter is a teacher, and bless her soul, she has very few students in her class. It's a very special class, but, you know, most times you get the bums rushed through the door. I remember when I was in high school, there wasn't anybody that particularly noted that I liked to write or anything. I was in journalism and all the journalism classes. So you hit the honeypot, essentially, when someone said to you, boy, Alex, you're really good at this. I think you should keep going and do more.
I think that there was that encouragement, and there also was the counterbalance to that you mentioned, you know, the typical family that wants somebody to go to medical school instead. I still had that. And I think what happened was my grandfather on my father's side, that side of the family is very had more traditional careers. A lot of them were lawyers or engineers by training, and
more
pragmatic
versus creative. You
very
mean.
Pragmatic, and they're lovely people, and some of them just don't connect with the arts, and or they do at a certain level, but they don't really kind of get it. And I think when it hit, I think my dad and my mom were kind of anomalies in their family, and they were creative, and I kind of felt like with my dad, there was kind of the sense of, I think for a little bit, of trying to steer us back on track, because he had deviated from that track that his family was on. So when I was in my early 20s and first starting out as a musician, you know, they would cut out articles about how hard it was to make money as a musician. And they would, you know, they really did kind of try to, like, discourage me from that for a little bit. And then I think, like, after a couple years, when I'd kind of done a couple recordings and I'd started to do some of the festival work, I think they, it kind of clicked in for them, where they kind of got a sense that this wasn't a passing thing, and then I kind of knew what
okay.
I was doing, and
right.
and they kind of respected me for it.
How wonderful.
But
that,
I think even with a family like that, that was, I was going to say, even with a family like that, that was predisposed to being creative. I think that there was that, you know, there's that thing where you care for your kids and you want them to do well, and you don't want them to, you know, you want to steer them away from
starving artists, even though they are, right? Your
exactly,
parents could
yeah.
have been starving artists, and they know what a rough road they had, and they want it easier for you. But you're right, you know. See, you were an adult, a young adult, and they still supported you, and that's wonderful. I think it's terrific. I want to talk to you a little bit about Lipquake, because I'm familiar with it, but I'm not sure that a lot of our readers and listeners are. Let's talk about Lipquake and how you got involved with the Lipquake Festival, and tell exactly what it is, please.
So Lipquake is the San Francisco Bay Area's biggest writing-related festival, and it happens the big part of the festival happens in October for about 2 weeks, and then there are events that take place throughout the year in San Francisco. So Lipquake has become this entity where there'll be festivals throughout the year, all over the city. But it culminates in this two-week festival of kind of nonstop writing events, and then Lit Crawl, which is basically the largest literary pub crawl in the country. And, you know, all these bars open their doors, and you just kind of walk. It almost feels like you're not in America, because it's the sense of going down to a, you know, walking down the street and having all these, wandering into these bars whose doors are open and just seeing stuff, seeing these little sparks in each of these places. So I got involved because I was living in New York for a while, and I was moving back to California, and my former agent was working with this festival, and I connected with her, and I said, you know, I'm coming back from New York. I'd love to connect with other people in the writing community in San Francisco. How do I do it? And
right.
she said, you know, start out by volunteering here. And then, you know, I ended up growing, so I was part of the executive committee for a couple of years, and just after this past year, just stepped down for time commitments. But it's a blast, and they do such a great job to create energy around writing.
How wonderful.
And
fun. You know, for the writers, it sounds like fun, but imagine being a festival goer and being exposed to all these creative people. To me, would be, that's the benefit of going to conferences and fairs and things like that. Had I been living in Miami still, I would be at, you know, it just finished up the Miami Book Fair International, which is huge and a lot of fun to go to. But I'm on the other side of the state now, and I did not go. But those events are so important, I think, for everyone, for culture, for I think that we need those things. I think we need more of them. We need a Lipquake in every city, quite honestly. Now, to some extent or the other, don't you think?
I do, and there are Lipquake, there are actually satellite Lipquake festivals that are popping up elsewhere in the country. Yeah, if people are curious about it, if you go to, it's like Earthquake, but Lipquake, so like literature, LITquake.org. If anyone's curious, and you can check out some of the stuff they're doing, some of the satellite organizations, and if you want to get involved, the thing that I loved about it is that, like a lot of writing festivals, what shocks me is how little pretense people have, like how open people are to meeting each other, which you don't always find in festivals. But everyone, you know, I've met so many people through going to festivals like Litquake and now a few other festivals. And it's amazing how many people just want to make a connection and aren't standoffish.
It's
people who are
true.
Big name writers, like they are just, there was, I was talking
just
to,
right there with you. Yeah.
Yeah. I was talking to John Lesquois, and he had such
He's
a great,
wonderful.
He has such a grounded sense of who he is. And this is a guy that has 28
yes.
best-selling novels out. And he sort of said, yeah, there's this perception that that writers are celebrities, and we're just not. and I just love, because he's a super successful guy, and he's doing quite well.
He's wonderful.
And yet he's never really lost his humanity. He hasn't gone full Kanye on us yet.
Never will. I think I told you when I met him, I was almost in tears because I had read all his books. And so the first Thriller Fest I ever went to, I walked over to him, and I you know, the radio show was very small then. We didn't have the network that we have now. And I just said, oh, God, will you please be on my show? And he put his arm around me, and he said, sure. And he whips out his whatever his fancy phone was, and he goes, let's make a date. And I write everything on paper. I have a paper calendar. And I pulled out the calendar. My hands were shaking. He says, you just tell me when you want me to come on. And I said, what date do you want to be on? And he tells me the date and gave me his phone number and his email, and that's how John Lesquois and I became friends. He is an amazing man, for sure. You're right. He's just like, I'm not a celebrity, but I think you and John Lesquois are my celebrities. You are my celebrities because I don't own a television. I think anyone who can write a book and get it published and people buy it and read it, you are a celebrity to me. So I don't care what you say. I think it's really cool.
Well, I think that's awesome, and I'll take it.
You got it. So I want to talk about the book itself.
Let's talk about the book.
The Empress of Tempera. I want to talk about this book because I love the funky names that you have given your characters, but I'm particularly fond of your main character. She's changed her name for a reason. She's changed herself. She is an incredible, incredibly interesting character to me. Please tell the story.
Sure. So she is originally from Maine, and she's moved down to New York really to reinvent herself. And she's the daughter of criminals. That's what we know about her going into it. She's the daughter of kind of this infamous couple who were criminals and ended up kind of being growing up in the house of her grandmother, who was very, very cold, very off-putting, and she just grew up with no love and no self-confidence and decided to go down to New York like a lot of people do. She gravitated towards art and she wants to become an artist, and so she has known nothing but a stigma that's been attached to her name, so she's abandoned her name. And she's somebody who is prone to theatricality. She has a little bit of that criminal tendency that she's inherited from her parents, and she's trying to suppress that. But so she reinvents herself. She dresses in bolder colors. She has this theatrical name, which is Père Anjou, which comes from her growing up around pear orchards, and that being kind of the place that she felt safe and could hide from all these other people that are picking on her. And so when we start out, she's really just, she's faking it, really. She's just changed her name legally. And she's still pretty young. She's about 19, 20 years old in art school. And, she's faking confidence, but she hasn't really grown into herself yet. And that's kind of through all the stuff that she has to go through in this book, she ends up kind of coming out the other side and really reinventing herself the way she's wanted to.
She's an interesting character to me because, first of all, her youth gives her a certain naivete, but also she's a little bit more worldly than we give her that normally a 19 or 20 year old would be, because given her set of circumstances with her folks and everything else. But I do like the fact that she reinvents herself. I like that very much. It drew me right into the story immediately. I have to tell you, it was a wonderful characterization for a main character that I sat up and took notice of her right away. Your writing is very meticulous. It seems to me there's not a word that is placed without a lot of thought. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's so lovely to read your work that's why I said I feel like it's literary suspense and literary thrillers, because it's so precise. It just is unlike anything I've ever read, and it's a very soothing way to read too. So thank you for that experience.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was on an interview a few months ago on this network with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross, who I had so much fun with. And we kind of talked about this.
There are crazy little aunt and uncle we kind of keep hidden at the back of the network, but they're lots of fun and they're very sharp, aren't they?
They're lots of fun, and we, the three of us, have a very similar sense of humor, so we got to giggle a lot in that interview. But they were asking me about what kind of influence that writing music would have had on writing fiction. And, I hadn't really spent a whole lot of time thinking about it, because I always thought of it as two fairly different disciplines. But I think there's something about writing lyrics where I think about the word choice a lot more writing lyrics, because, there's a meter to
right.
it, and there's, there are rhyming schemes and all this stuff. And
sure.
And there's an economy of words. I think poets probably would associate with this. There's this economy of words where you have to, you only get a handful of words to express what you want to express. And
exactly.
I think some of that probably leaked into how I write prose, where I just I like the sound of language. There are writers like Haruki Murakami, Nabokov, who there's a lyrical quality to what they do where it just sounds really good when you read it.
I understand.
Yeah.
And I think you have really mastered that in your two books. I want you to know, I believe that. I felt that way about even Pat Conroy's work and I'm particularly fond of The Prince of Tides, not because of the movie, but because of the book. I've read it only about 10 times, but that book I will read out loud because of the nuance of the dialogue, the timbre, the way the words are formed. It's poetic to me. I love language so much, and you're right, it has a lot to do with music. I really believe that because I love music so much too. Fantastic. What are you working on now?
So I'm working on my agent just went out with book three, and book three is called The Mourner, which is a lot easier for people to pronounce. It's about
maybe
this,
the morning by the time you get your book, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's about the time of day. No, it's Mourner.
It's
about this phenomenon that I saw doing a lot of so a lot of my work has been international in the last over the last 10 years or so. And you see this thing in other countries that you don't see in the U.S., which is there's an industry of mourology, is the official word for it, but it's professional mourning. It's people that are hired to cry and wail at people's funerals, and there are lots of reasons for it. There could be, it could be undignified for somebody who is close to the deceased to express emotion themselves, and so it's good to have a surrogate. It's sort of a way to make that person seem more likable and celebrated in death It's a way to kind of achieve a critical mass by adding more people and to make that person's death seem more significant. There's a lot of reasons for it. At the same time, the people that do that profession are are seen as the bottom of the barrel. They're like this. They're looked on the way we would look on a drug dealer. That industry hasn't cracked into the U.S., so I thought it would be interesting with a lot of really wealthy and loathsome people in this country that if those people had disposable income to make themselves seem more likable when they died, wouldn't it be interesting if somebody was able to set up a cottage industry of professional mourning? And my main character is a young man in New York.
Oh, God, you said it now, and you know someone's going to pick up on this. And we'll have you to thank or not thank for that. I'll remember this conversation for a long time.
My main character is the highest paid professional mourner in New York City.
How interesting. That's fabulous. I love that. And speaking of mourning, MOURNING, when I was a kid and we used to hear the mourning doves outside, I thought they were there in the morning, MORNING, it was not until much later on that I realized they were mourning doves, and I still didn't understand why they were called that, because I only heard them in the morning.
I think I did the same thing.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
It's interesting, our perceptions, because they do sound like they're sad, don't they? But you just don't recognize that until you understand the real name for those birds. It's hysterical. I want to ask you my final five. It's five quick questions and five quick answers. Are you game?
I am game.
Okay, well, it's also called Stump the Author. I guess I should have told you that, too. But let's see how we do. So I know that you make music. You are a musician. But who do you prefer to listen to? What kind of music and whom do you prefer to listen to?
I go all over the map. And so there aren't genres that I tend to listen to. The thing that I've been listening to a lot this week is the new Tribe Called Quest album. So they've released their first album.
Yeah, everybody's listening. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great album.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sampling on that album, and one is at the opening song is a police siren, and I was grooving along to this, and I was thinking in my car, and I was thinking, oh my God, this sample is perfect. The siren is perfect. And then I realized there was a fire truck behind me and I had to pull over.
Priceless. I love that. But a lot of people are listening, and that's because they lost one of their members. And, you know, a great group anyway. So, and I was listening too, so I can understand that. Whose book are you reading?
There is an author named Catherine Rowe, R-O-W-E, mm-hmm. and she wrote a true crime book called The Spider and the Fly. And so it's nonfiction. And I actually don't read much true crime, despite the fact that I kind of write in the thriller genre. And her book's about this relationship that she started with a serial killer from Poughkeepsie, New York, which is in upstate New York, right on the Hudson River. And abductions. There had been 8 missing women over the course of several years. And they kind of thought it was this guy, and he finally confessed. And she wanted to figure out what made him tick. And so it's that sort of in cold blood story that everyone would, sort of make that parallel. But what makes the book interesting is that, for me, is that beyond that, the book is as much about her own revelations about herself and her family than as it is about this guy, where she's thinking, who am I? Like, what kind of person am I that I'm so drawn to someone like this? And what does it say about me? And then she kind of uncovers she's very transparent about the stuff, her relationship with her family, and it's part memoir. And the added layer that made it special for me was reading about what, you know, her own life. And this was just kind of a mirror back on her life and what it meant to her that she was so obsessed with this.
I actually know someone that this happened to, who was married to someone who turned out to be a serial killer in Florida. Someone I went to high school with. Isn't that bizarre?
Was it a case that we would all know?
Yes, and so I can't say the name. But yes, it is very well known. Yeah, real well known. Interesting. We'll talk about it sometime. It's an interesting thing. Do you prefer nonfiction to fiction, or are you you don't care one way or the other? You're drawn to both.
I like both. I tend to read fiction more than nonfiction, but part of it too is that I will intentionally try to give myself some variety. If I feel like, you know, if I'm reading five abduction stories in a row, I'll start to glaze over a little bit, even though those five books may be incredible. Like, I'll need something to break it up. So, part of it is just getting some variety in there. So I tend to read fiction more than nonfiction. Yeah.
Okay. Would you ever like to write in a different genre? And if so, which?
It's a good question, and I think that it presupposes that, like, that writing a book that's categorized as a thriller means that I write thrillers. Like, this is something I talk about on my show, Thrill Seekers, a lot, of the idea of thrillers really kind of being this artificial marketing term that I'm comfortable with because it helps readers get in touch with writers that they want to read.
Let me backtrack before you go and say this. Then you write crime fiction. So would you prefer to write a different type in a different genre, like horror or science fiction, or would you prefer to stay in crime fiction and bring in elements of other genres? Maybe that's the way I should ask you.
Well, to directly answer your question, I would be interested in writing other genres. There are writers like there's a guy I really like named Michael Faber, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but it's Faber, and he writes a different genre. He's like the Ang Lee of literary fiction, and his first book is basically a horror novel called Under the Skin, and then he wrote a period piece called The Crimson Petal in the White. And then he just had a book out last year called, I'm forgetting the title, but it was basically a science fiction book. And the thing is, he just nails it. He's just such a great writer. Like, it doesn't matter what genre he's in. He just killed it. And so I think for book four, I'm starting to play around with a little supernatural element. It's a prominent feature of the story, but so that's different for me.
I love it. Fantastic. What book have you read more than one time? It's your go-to book or books that once a year, come hell or high water, you've got to read that book because it's just so darn good.
I don't reread a lot, but I'd say Jitterbug Perfume by Tom Robbins, I really like. I love the imagination behind it.
Wow.
It's very
That's
different from
too.
The kind of stuff I write, but I love it.
Yeah. Oh, good for you. So, what's your dog's name again?
Her name is Issa. It's short for Isabel. It was the name she came with, but I saw no reason to change it.
And how are things working out with all that training that you keep saying is not working? Is she finally getting it?
She's finally getting it. She for people listening, she's a street dog from Guatemala, and she's about 15 months old right now. And so she kind of looks like if you took a deer and miniaturized a deer, it would look like my dog. And she's adorable.
She's beautiful,
but she's starting
to. She really is.
She's a gorgeous dog. Yeah. But she's matured a little bit, so she's less. Her big problem was that she was afraid of everything, and that's why she was getting vocal. But she's you know, she's started to not be as vocal, which is nice.
My last question to you is, I just had to ask about Issa anyway. That wasn't part of the final five. My last question to you is, if you were not this creative person that you are, what profession other than you are, than your own would you like to attempt?
I have to go outside of anything that's creative?
Well, I don't know. You tell me, it's your question and your answer. This is your life,
okay,
not mine.
Okay, so I probably would funnel through other ways to channel creative energy if it wasn't for writing. And that's kind of what happened, where I was juggling music and writing for a while and decided that I really wanted to be really good at one thing instead of juggling and being okay at both. So I probably would try to figure out some outlet for that. But I think, especially in the wake of things that are happening this fall, I think I probably would want to do something that was had to do with social advocacy. I'd probably, you know, really try to kind of push my day job a little bit more, where I was doing a little bit more to drive social impact.
Good for you. Author Alex Dolan, who's also a musician, a social justice advocate, and just an all-around good guy, I'm so glad that we had this conversation this evening. Thank you so much for being my guest. Who's next on your show?
I have, tomorrow I have the triumphant return of Laura McHugh, who had a great book out last year called The Weight of Blood, or I'm sorry, just Weight of Blood. And her second book,
yes,
Arrowwood, is just coming out, and she's a fantastic writer, and she's
yes,
a really
she
cool
is.
Person. So she's it's going to be airing tomorrow, and then on Wednesday, I'm doing an interview with Belinda Bauer in the UK, who's fantastic.
Fun. How fun. I hope you are having a good time with Thrill Seekers. Where can we find you on the web?
The best place to go is my website is www.alexdolan.com or alexdolan.com, and that will give you my social network links, and it'll give you all the information you'd want, and especially on the show Thrill Seekers, where it has a catalog of interviews you can check out.
Very good. Alex, thank you so much for being my guest. We have to do this more often. It's a lot of fun talking to you, and I suspect that there are a lot of untapped subjects that we could still talk about, maybe for a long time.
I would
will
absolutely
you come back
love
one
that,
day?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes,
good.
Absolutely.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Thank you so much. And by the way, everybody, speaking of blending music and books, on Wednesday I'll be speaking to Ed Imar and DJ Alchemist, who have decided to put short story crime fiction to music. She is a DJ. He is a writer. It's going to be real interesting. And we're going to debut one of his songs on Wednesday. That's 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific time. Please join me and go and see and listen to Alex Dolan's show, Thrill Seekers, and the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Alex, have a lovely evening and a happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. And a kiss on the nose to Issa for me, okay?
Yay. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. Bye. Good night.
All right. Bye.
And thank you for listening, everyone. Have a lovely Thanksgiving, but don't forget me on Wednesday night. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.